The Presumptions of Whiteness.
I think I'm always writing to explore what I understand of what I call the presumptions of whiteness that I grew up with, the assumptions that we have just coming from the dominant culture, and the kinds of biases that are subtle.
That's Rilla Askew. We talk with her about her spellbinding novel, Kind of Kin. It's the first I know of to confront anti-immigrant hatred, its reign of terror, and how it's tearing families apart. And Rebecca Coleman once again plumbs the outer limits of what ordinary people are capable of doing.
With both of these characters, I really tried to take the reader on a sort of dark flight of fancy. If you allowed yourself to be taken over by that emotion, what would happen? And then you kind of go along on it, and hopefully at the end of it you realize, whew, glad I didn't do that.
We talk to her about her new novel, Heaven Should Fall. That's all coming up on today's Writer's Voice. I'm Francesca Rhiannon. Novelist Rilla Askew says America is her subject, her native Oklahoma, her canvas. From her celebrated debut novel about the Tulsa race riots, Fire in Beulah, to her latest, Kind of Kin, Askew mines the rich, paradoxical lode of American myths about race and national identity, and the human realities they mask. Kind of Kin, released this week, takes place after Oklahoma passes one of the earliest and toughest anti-illegal immigration laws in the nation, which it did in 2007. Like all such laws, it's tearing families apart and terrorizing whole communities, not to speak of riding roughshod over basic human rights. Rilla Askew knows her family is one of them. In the novel, a grandfather's Christian belief leads him to violate the law. A daughter's love leads her to change her long-standing beliefs about others, and a young grandson embarks on an odyssey that will put him in danger as he tries to save another. These are some of Askew's richly drawn characters. Her skillfully wielded pen offers the reader comedy, tragedy, and nail-biting suspense. It also brings us face-to-face with ourselves. Rilla Askew, welcome to Writer's Voice.
Thank you.
This book, Kind of Kin, it was really a page-turner. It's the first novel I've seen that really sets its sights square on the issue of the impact of the immigration laws that have been sweeping the U.S., particularly in the South. This takes place in Oklahoma. There have been others in Arizona and in Alabama.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I did not know that Oklahoma was, in fact, the first place to pass an immigration law of this kind. Tell us about this House Bill 1804.
It was passed in 2007, which is the centennial year of Oklahoma. Oklahoma is a very young state, just became a state in 1907. So in that centennial year, in the spring, the Oklahoma State Legislature passed House Bill 1804, and it was, if not the first of its kind, one of the very first of its kind. It may have been the very first, and it was certainly a great surprise to many of us in Oklahoma. Not only when it passed, but when it went into effect in November of that year. And just in the months surrounding the time that it went into effect, there were many, many, primarily Hispanic people in Oklahoma who were stopped for driving violations or other sorts of violations and infractions and, you know, sent to immigration detention centers and eventually deported. So how that bill came about, my understanding is that it was an Oklahoma state representative. It was his idea, and he put it forward, and it was not one of the ones that, you know, sponsored by Chris Kobach, who is the Kansas Secretary of State, as many know, who was the advisor to Governor Romney on immigration issues and has helped design state legislation. In Arizona, he helped write that law, or helped design it, let me say, in Alabama, and I believe Georgia as well. But my understanding is that this was before that.
Well, I found this book, I mean, not only is it a terrific novel, but It really made me understand on a gut level just how terrifying these laws are. In the novel, the bill has been passed, and as Kind of Kin opens up, we are with 10-year-old Dustin, who is staying with his aunt Sweet, her husband and his cousin, who's a little bit older. Why is he there?
He's there because his grandfather, with whom he lives, because he's an orphan, essentially, his grandfather has been arrested under the provisions of the fictional state bill, which in has a different number, but it's modeled on the actual House Bill 1804. He's been the boy's grandfather, Bob Brown, has been arrested for harboring illegal aliens in his barn in a little rural town in southeastern Oklahoma called Cedar. So when the grandfather is arrested, there's no one to take care of Dustin, and so he has to go stay with his aunt.
And Dustin's grandpa is described in the very first pages as, quote, a felon and a Christian. This is an unusual pairing of two words, but very relevant to this novel. Why is he a felon and a Christian?
Well, it's a felony, according to the state law, to harbor or transport any undocumented worker or, quote, unquote, illegal alien. And Bob Brown is a very strong Christian man. He has a strong faith, and he sees it as part of his Christian responsibility to welcome the stranger, as Jesus put it. I was a stranger, and you took me in to provide this place of shelter for these undocumented workers. And so, when he's arrested, he's committed a felony. And he and the fellow he's arrested with, who's a Pentecostal pastor named Jesus Garcia, who's a friend of his, they decide to stand against that law and to not bail out of jail, you know, bond out, but to remain incarcerated in order to stand against the law. So, but this leaves Dustin in quite a difficult situation.
And why is Bob Brown, Dustin's grandpa, what has brought him to a place where he was willing to take in undocumented workers who were looking for refuge and shelter?
You know, the way I think of it, or the way that I imagine it, is that he has it's completely allied with his sense of Christianity and with his sense of what his responsibility is as a man of faith. He's he doesn't belong to a particular denomination. Though he doesn't belong to a certain denomination, he's pretty strong in his beliefs. And so he thinks that this is what he's been charged with. And there are also other personal situations that give him a strong affinity for people who are in this country illegally. They're, you know, personal situations, and also his friendship with Jesus Garcia, who is Hispanic. He goes to that, Bob Brown goes to that church sometimes. Mm-hmm. It's just a part of his Christian stance. There's a very strong evangelical sanctuary movement that was already in place even before these state laws began to be enacted, and became even stronger, where churches would become sanctuaries for undocumented workers.
And
so they were standing against the laws of the state. And finally, federal laws as well, because it's also, there's a distinction between the federal law, which does not include elements having to do with, for instance, giving sanctuary to or sheltering undocumented workers.
There's a very telling scene in your book, Rilla Askew, in Kind of Kin, which takes place in the home of another grandchild of Bob Brown's. She is older, and she's married to a Mexican who has come here, who is undocumented. Could you describe a little bit about that scene? It felt to me like one that really puts into stark relief what you've just been talking about.
Are you thinking of the scene where...
At the picnic.
At the picnic, yes. Yeah. Well, isn't that America? There's an Anglo family, as This is a term that a number of my American Indian friends would basically call white people. It's a white family intermarried with a Mexican family. And so there's a birthday party for the child of Misty Dawn, the granddaughter that you're speaking of, and her husband, Juanito. And at this party, the Mexican family and the Anglo family are all in the yard celebrating at a big barbecue. But there's a language barrier whereby the Mexicans do not go to the side where the Anglos are, and the Anglos don't go to the Mexican side, not out of animosity, but out of not really being able to communicate in the way that, you know, two families coming together for the birthday of a grandchild might ordinarily be able to do. And yet they're all unified by this marriage. So there's tension. There's suspicion on the part of some of the characters. And then there's the young woman, Misty Dawn, who wants to bring her two families together.
And one person is able to go across the divide. That's the grandfather, in spite of the
That's
fact.
That's the grandfather.
Yeah. That's a very telling scene. And you've described this as a novel about people who want to do right but still do wrong, and others who do right in spite of themselves. Could you put that in context? Give us an example of that in the story.
One of the main characters is Aunt Sweet. Well, actually, as we say in Oklahoma, Aunt Sweet, who's Destin's aunt and Misty Dawn's aunt, and she's the one who tries her best to hold her family together. Bob Brown, the grandfather, is her father. He's in jail. She's charged with taking care of this little boy, with trying to arrange things for Misty Dawn, and who's, you know, left in dire straits because her husband has been deported. And so Sweet tries the best she can to hold her family together, and she keeps making mistakes, not out of ill will, simply because she doesn't really know how to deal with all the pressures that have come to bear on her family because of this law and because of her father's action in the face of this law. So she's the one who wants to do right and still does wrong. There are other characters, and I would say probably Bob Brown is one of them, who does right in spite of himself, because the consequences of him taking this action, his family suffers. And yet the awakening in the community and people outside of his family to the consequences of the laws have a really good, strong effect.
You're listening to Writer's Voice, and we're talking with Rilla Askew about her new novel, just out this week, Kind of Kin. Now, how much of this book is actually based on reality? I mean, I understand that you have a situation in your own family which comes close to one of the situations in this book. Is that right?
Mm-hmm. Yes. I have a niece who was married to an undocumented worker, and as a result of that law, her husband was deported. So we had a family situation where we, you know, came to experience the results of that law and also the complications of the broken immigration system. One of the things I wanted to do in the book is not write a polemic or not write a position that's only one way of looking at the circumstance. And yes, there has been, over the course of many years, an increasing population of people who don't have legal status and yet live here and, you know, marry here and have children here and work here. And it's grown over the course of decades so that many, many families are affected. And the families that are affected are not necessarily all Hispanic families. And, of course, immigration issues apply to all immigrant populations. And so the question is very, very large. But in this particular case, I was able to experience what happens when a family is shattered because one of the members is deported. And that's something that most, you know, middle-class white families, probably the majority of us, don't necessarily experience firsthand. We may have opinions about it or even sentiments about it, but then when you experience it firsthand, it becomes very, very personal. But the characters and the circumstance are all imagined. so, you know, sweet is fictional. Bob Brown is fictional. They're not based on
actual
real
people.
Yes, even the state legislator who is the sponsor of the bill is nothing, not even by gender, nothing like the actual state representative who did originally sponsor the real House Bill 1804. So I've created a fictional world and fictional characters, but the places are all real. So the little town of Cedar is very much modeled on the town where I am now, where my parents live, a small town in the mountains of southeastern Oklahoma. The small town of Wilburton, which is in this same area, it's factual. When Sweet wants to go talk to her father and has to go stand outside the jail, outside the yard, to be able to talk to him because they don't allow visitors inside the jail. That's all fact. That's how they do it in Latimer County, Oklahoma. So there are many circumstances that are real, and yet there are characters who are fictional who are living out the consequences of real conditions.
Could you say a little bit about the impact on your family? Were there children involved in...
Yes, mm-hmm. yes. Yes, and that is the model in you know, for the book is pretty close to that as well, which is that they did have a daughter. They do have a daughter who's, you know, much older than that now, but she was a preschooler when those things happened, and, you know, her father was there, and then he was not.
And how did that affect her?
She became very withdrawn. She was already a very quiet child. And at first she asked questions, and then she stopped asking questions, and then she stopped asking about her father.
Wow.
And then the struggle, the financial struggle that my niece went through, you know, you're a two-income family, and then suddenly you don't have that other income. And you know, trying to navigate the labyrinthine regulations of immigration and, you know, all those things are really a challenge for the working poor.
And one also experiences the sense of terror that people have, the terror of the hunted.
The terror of the hunted and the knowledge that my niece had that if she were, for instance, just stopped driving her husband to work, she would be arrested for a felony. Her daughter would be taken by, you know, DHS, Department of Human Services. He would be deported. Now, this was before he actually was. That just living with your husband is a felony, and they're legally married, but they were legally married, but it didn't make any difference in terms of the immigration laws. And that's something else that a lot of people don't understand, people who are not familiar with how complicated the immigration process is, especially for people out from, you know, Central and South America. The rules are different for them. We don't have a sort of quota that as we do for perhaps Eastern European countries. So when people talk about go back and get in line, what I learned, you know, through the experience of my niece is that they went through the entire process. And her husband had come here as a young boy. Well, we know how there's much talk about that these days relative to the Dream Act and so forth. He'd come here as a young, really as a youth, an early adolescent child, and had lived here in that time, and they married and had a child and went through all of the processes to get his immigration status legitimized. And the only thing that they had left to do was that he would have to go back to Mexico and apply to come legally. And they were told that it would be at least 10 years.
10 years with a preschool child.
Yeah.
Now, has she been able to see her father at all?
No. No. The ultimate circumstance is that my niece and her husband divorced. Mm-hmm. So, no, the little girl doesn't see her dad.
Oh, that's just terrible. We're talking with Rilla Askew about immigration and the anti-immigrant laws in America. She's written a terrific novel, a real page-turner, Kind of Kin, which takes this up as the central issue of the book. Now, I'd like to go to talking a little bit about the legislator, the character in the book, Monica, mm-hmm. who, you know, what are her motivations in all this? Because it feels to me that they're not exactly pure.
They're not exactly pure. You know, it's interesting because I really don't know how to write. I have no idea what's in the minds of the actual state legislators who create these laws. And so I created a fictional character so that I could get inside her mind. And the character that I've created is simply ambitious. She would do whatever seemed necessary to further her career as a state legislator. She has her eyes on becoming a U.S. congresswoman. She wants to go to Washington. So in the fiction, she is merely using this state law to further her career, which gives me a lot of freedom fictionally. And I can't speak to what others do. I mean, it's true that we have a broken immigration system that needs great attention. But why these draconian laws that so impact families have become, in the last few years, something, you know, very popular in certain areas, I can't speak to that because I don't know.
Mm-hmm.
It doesn't seem the American way, and yet when you think back to our greatest moments of national shame, they've almost always been legislative circumstances that targeted a people, whether they were the Indian Removal Acts that created the Trail of Tears, where the five civilized tribes were forced marched to what is now Oklahoma, to Indian Territory, or, you know, the incarceration of Japanese during World War II, slavery. You know, we can go back and look at you know, the Jim Crow laws of the American South. We can look at a lot of legislative actions that have taken place that have targeted a people, and that seems to be what this is as well.
And this is something that you've taken up in other books, not the immigration issue per se, but the clash of cultures and racial scapegoating.
Mm-hmm.
You wrote about this in your award-winning book about the Tulsa riots, Fire in Beulah. Why have these issues been so central to your own development as a writer?
It's because I come from Indian Territory. It's because I come from Oklahoma. And I come from a place where, by many measures, was the worst race riot that ever happened in American history. The Tulsa race riot took place 50 miles from the little town where I grew up, and I never knew about it. It was completely covered up after it happened. And I didn't learn about it until I had long moved away from Oklahoma, was living in Brooklyn, and had begun to write. And I learned about it and learned not only that it happened, but also why it happened. And it happened in many ways, for many reasons, but largely because African-American people were so strong in Oklahoma, in the former Indian Territory. It had been the promised land for many African-Americans who came here to escape the devastations in the South, in the post-Reconstruction South. So the coming together of these three cultures, Anglo, American Indian, and African American, in such a strong and sometimes violent way here, helped shape me. And then I also just have personal experience that changes my view of the world. My family, they're my God family. I call them my God children, and they're like my adoptive family. They're Jamaican, and they live in Brooklyn, and so that's one view of the world. And so my godson Travis, I've helped raise him since he was first born 23 years ago, and so I know what it's like to love and be afraid for a young black man in America. I've watched him with his encounters with the police in Brooklyn, that in, you know, bearing witness to things that are written about all the time, but not a lot of people who are from my culture necessarily witness. So that's one witness for me. My niece's situation with her husband is another witness. My deep friendships with another number of American Indian people here in Oklahoma gives me another way of viewing the world. And so I think all those things, and then I also come from a very strong background of religious faith. You know, I grew up in a Southern Baptist church. My dad's a deacon, and I grew up with a lot of emphasis on accepting others, and go the second mile, and love your neighbor, and love your enemies, and yet also bear witness to that kind of faith being used to excoriate others, or to create laws that oppress. So it's a cauldron here in Oklahoma, and I think anyone else who's from this part of the country knows that. I mean, all of America is this way, but it's intensified in this particular place. So I'm really shaped by place and culture.
You also, I think, are extraordinarily sensitive to the inner process of the Anglos in book. Particularly with Aunt Sweet, who, confronts, because we're listening in on her thoughts, she's certainly not censoring them. She confronts her own prejudices and the kind of hump she has to get over. She has a situation in her own family where, her trying to help the situation is not looked upon kindly. there's a real struggle here, and I think you do that with extraordinary nuance and sensitivity. Could you talk a little bit about that as an Anglo?
Yeah, thank you so much, and for that compliment. I think I'm always writing to explore what I understand of what I call the presumptions of whiteness that I grew up with, the assumptions that we have just coming from the dominant culture, and the kinds of biases that are subtle. So I think that the personal relationships in my life that have given me deep friendships and, in fact, love with people of color have helped open my eyes to the assumptions and presumptions that I have and privileges that I of skin color that I have, just coming not only from the culture that I do, but also from the class that I do, which means I grew up working class, but working middle class. Mm-hmm. So those things have given me insight into my own biases, and a desire to illuminate them and to be honest about them. And in my novel, Fire in Beulah, which is about the Tulsa race riot, I gave a number of these kinds of prejudices, I would say, to the main white character, and promised myself that I would not blink, promised myself that I would not try to whitewash, so to speak, her inner life. And I think I've been doing that ever since. What I know is that most of the people I come in contact with from the dominant culture, from my culture, are people of goodwill and good heart. But sometimes we're blinded to how whatever privilege is given to us is taken from someone else. So the great joy of reading and the great joy of being a novelist is that you get to live inside a character. While you're writing it, you do, and it's my great joy as a reader of the wonderful novelists that I've been able to, delve in and live in their fictional world, throughout all of my reading life. You understand the inner workings of their heart. And so that's my ambition, I guess, is to illuminate the truth, to tell the truth in a way that is not judgmental, but that is also not sentimental.
Mm. Well, you do it masterfully in this book, Kind of Kin. I strongly recommend it to all our listeners. Rilla Askew, it's been a privilege to talk with you today. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Francesca.
Rilla Askew is the author of several novels, including Harpsong, Fire in Beulah, and Strange Business, as well as numerous short stories. Among other honors, she received a 2009 Arts and Letters Award from the American Academy of Arts and Letters. She lives in Oklahoma. And for our Western Massachusetts listeners, Rilla Askew will be appearing at the Odyssey Bookshop in South Hadley, Massachusetts on January 14th at 7 p.m. Next up, Rebecca Coleman and Heaven Should Fall. Stay tuned after the break. Welcome back to Writer's Voice. I'm Francesca Rhiannon. Novelist Rebecca Coleman is interested in what happens when people are driven by their obsessions to blow past the boundaries of acceptable behavior. In her first novel, The Kingdom of Childhood, which we talked to her about last year, a female teacher becomes sexually obsessed with one of her students, with disastrous consequences. In her new novel, Heaven Should Fall, a young man becomes obsessed with revenge. But it's more than a personal issue. He's enraged by what he sees as the insults his government has inflicted on his family. Cade Olmsted, a working-class guy from New Hampshire, did all the right things. He graduated from college, and he married his pregnant girlfriend. But he can't find a job, and he and his wife have had to move back to his parents' home. His beloved brother, a veteran of Afghanistan, has also come back home from the war, a severely damaged man. It eats at Cade until he decides to take his revenge against his government by becoming a terrorist. Heaven Should Fall explores how the stresses coming to bear on so many American families, war, unemployment, poverty, combine in the cauldron of one such family to produce an explosive result. Rebecca Coleman, welcome back to Writer's Voice.
Thank you. Nice to talk to you.
We're talking to you now about your newest novel, Heaven Should Fall. This is, in some ways, also a dark character study, just as the last novel we spoke to you about, which was The Kingdom of Childhood, but under very different circumstances. Tell us a little bit of what the novel is about.
Well, it's about a young woman named Jill, and she's a college student. She's dating a man named Cade, who's also a college student, and he aspires to be a congressman or work in government like that. And when his brother Elias comes back from Afghanistan, his brother is clearly troubled. It comes out that he's suffering from PTSD. And when Jill and Cade move up to the family farm to wait out the birth of their child, Jill gradually realizes that Elias is not well off at all. And the story is about how everything kind of hits the fan for the family when they struggle to help him out and fail to, and then Cade wants revenge for what's gone wrong with his brother.
Do you want us not to talk about the fact that his brother commits suicide?
No, well, we can talk about that.
Oh, okay. Well, one of the things that I love so much about this novel, as well as the last one, and I think I've mentioned the word here, is character. So first off, let's go through some of these characters, because they are marvelously drawn. Tell us about Jill.
Jill is kind of the voice of reason in the novel. She's a young woman. She's 20, 21 when it opens. And her mother was in Alcoholics Anonymous, but as far as Jill remembers, was a recovering alcoholic, so she was never drinking. And her mother was full of inspirational advice for how to get through things based on AA. I based that on the fact that I have a friend who's in NA, which is Narcotics Anonymous, and my friend has based a lot of her mothering on things that she has learned in NA, and it works out extraordinarily well. So a lot of those lessons can be applied to other things in life, and I have Jill kind of draw from that. But when it comes to Elias and his PTSD, it's not enough. You know, a person suffering the way Elias does needs more than that.
What does she try to tell him? What message, what AA message does she try to bring to him that she finds is not enough?
Well, she initially is trying to say to him, you know, you need to go to group therapy, you need to talk to people more, you kind of pull yourself up by your bootstraps, take responsibility type of attitude, which is good. It's better than what he had, but it's not sufficient, you know. And Elias is really my favorite character in the story because I really enjoy writing these troubled, conflicted characters. They're honestly more interesting to me than the one who's the voice of reason and has the right answers most of the time. And Elias has a troubled childhood, and then he saw really terrible things when he was at war. And the combination of those things, you know, really leads to his kind of mental breakdown.
And they become friends. I mean, we have to make clear here, we haven't really talked much about her husband or her boyfriend.
Cade. Well, he's her boyfriend, and he becomes her husband over the course of the novel.
Right. So Cade Olmsted, he is also quite an interesting character, also conflicted in a very different way than his brother. His brother seems to be in some ways a more genuinely sensitive person. Is that true?
Yeah, I think so. And that was one of the reasons that I really liked Elias. He and Cade were kind of mirror images in some ways of each other. And from a writing perspective, that was interesting to do. It was interesting to create this entire family where their different characteristics bounce off each other and also kind of bump up against each other in really explosive ways. Elias is a very quiet character with a lot going on inside him. And you can kind of see as he sits there and doesn't say very much, you can still really get a sense of how he has this churning humanity inside him, and he doesn't know how to articulate it very well. But Cade is a lot of bark and a lot of bite, and he has a lot of confidence and bravado, but there's not really a whole lot behind it to substantiate it, and he hasn't experienced enough in life because he's also 20 or 21 when the story begins. He knows how to present himself well, and he knows how to put up this confident facade, but once he's really challenged by life, he doesn't really have the experience to back it up, and then he doesn't know what to do.
And he goes to kind of an extreme in response to his brother Elias's suicide,
because he's very affected by the idea that people aren't considering him and his family to be important. He's very important to him to be important and to be recognized and to receive recognition. And so when he feels like his brother has been blown off by the government, that the government has used his brother as a soldier and then kind of discarded him, he's hurt by that for his brother's sake, but he's also kind of personally affronted by it. You know, how dare you, you know, government, not recognize that we are important people? And his reaction that if he wasn't going to be good at being good, you know, if he wasn't going to be able to have a job in government and affect change that way, then he was going to be good at being bad, you know. And that's something where I really studied the militia groups in the United States and the people who have done acts of domestic terrorism, which is where Cade goes with his whole revenge plan. And I looked at people like Tim McVeigh and what was behind their choices to commit their actions, and I based Cade on a lot of that.
Well, he also has been ignored in his own right. I mean, here's a kid who basically, you know, did the right thing, went to college, graduated, tried hard to get a job. Like so many young people his age these days, they're not getting back from society after having invested in doing the right thing in order to get a job. They're cut loose as well, isn't that right?
Right, and that intense frustration that he feels, and I think a lot of people feel, is behind a lot of his actions. And a lot of what he does is the things that a lot of us feel. Grief is one of them, anger, frustration, and he magnifies them to an extreme degree in the book. And so you get this story that's based on if you follow normal feelings to their inevitable extreme end, what is the result of that?
And the book is Heaven Should Fall. We're talking with the author, Rebecca Coleman. You know, all the characters in this book, they're very finely drawn. They're very human and also iconic at the same time. I found Leela, Cade's mother, to be a very personally affecting a character, a sympathetic character, and yet somebody who allowed the abuse of her child, Elias, when he was a kid, to go forth. So she's a very complex kind of a person.
Yeah, I've seen some reader reactions where some people really like her and they see her as being very realistic and sympathetic, and other people are very bothered that she stayed with Eddie, her husband, who rules the house with this, you know, iron fist. And they say, well, if she had really been a good woman, that she would have rebuffed him. And it seems to be a lot of younger people who say that. I think there are a lot of characters in this story, both Leela and Jill, where they're sort of my reaction to reading a lot of books where the female characters always have the right answers, and the female characters are always wise, and they're always strong. And I think that those are great qualities in female protagonists. But I think that in real life, I don't know about you, but I've made some mistakes. I've misjudged people's character. I've done things and then later thought, you know, that really wasn't the right reaction. I should have been more forceful. I should have stood up for myself. And so I wanted to include that in some of the female characters who are otherwise admirable, that they did have moments where they made mistakes and that they weren't always the epitome of strength and reason.
Oh, and of course, I've never made mistakes like that.
Well, good for you.
Oh, were it so true. Now, actually, I found the least sympathetic character to be Cade and Elias's sister, Candy. Tell us about her.
Yeah, she's quite a complex individual because she's a fundamentalist Christian. And I'm a Christian myself, so it's no, you know, affront to Christians, but she is definitely the extreme element. And she sees religion as a kind of tool by which she can judge people and by which she can feel better about herself, because she knows, as you see from her third-person point of view, that deep down she has some things about herself that she's not comfortable with at all. So she reacts to that by being very judgmental of others and by being very self-righteous. And yeah, I don't think she's at all sympathetic. I really work hard in writing these books to make even the fairly evil characters have occasional moments when you see that they're not entirely bad. Dodge in the book, who is Candy's husband, he's a pretty bad guy. But there are a few moments where he shows sympathy for people. But I don't think with Candy there's a single one where she acts in any way that's good.
And there's actually a plot line that didn't happen with her that I was expecting to unfold, so I thought I'd ask you about that. I mean, there seems some implication that she allowed somebody to drown.
Yeah, and at the end of the book, that comes out a little more, but what happens there is that there's a girl in town who has a crush on Elias, her brother. And Candy is jealous. She has this sort of weird jealous streak, possessive streak toward her brother, Elias, that goes throughout the book. And one day she is out at the frozen quarry lake that is a feature in the book. And the girl goes out on her skates and falls through the ice and drowns. And Candy witnesses it and is extremely slow to report what happened. And that is a plot line in the book, is how responsible Candy is for that, whether it was an event that she contrived. But what you see in Elias as it goes on is that Elias is one of the burdens he's carrying is knowing that Candy is responsible for that in some way, and that he can't tell anyone that because he's being loyal to his family.
And her mother is also aware of it.
The mother is not really aware. The mother, I think, is vaguely aware that something happened, but that is where her denial completely comes down. And I think Leela really does not believe that Candy is in any way responsible for it.
Oh, that's because, so funny, because I kind of read that into it.
Really?
Yeah.
I could very easily see that Leela knew in the back of her mind, but she just would not let her mind go there. She's like, no, poor Candy. This happened in front of her. So sad that she had to see that, the end.
You're listening to Writer's Voice, and we're talking with Rebecca Coleman about her new novel, Heaven Should Fall. Now this is a dysfunctional family par excellence, but there also is a character in this novel, Heaven Should Fall, who you know, is kind of in the background except at the end, who's a kind of a rescuer, somebody who is a friend of Jill's, who represents a very different kind of life, aspect of life, a wholesome one. Tell us about that, and why did you write him into this story?
Yeah, that's Dave. He runs a wilderness camp for teenagers who are in difficult circumstances. And Jill originally met him when she went there as part of a Alateen group, where her mother put her in a group of kids whose mothers are also in recovery. And so Jill went to this summer camp when she was younger, and she met Dave there. And when she first started going there, Dave is about 10, 12 years older than her. So if she started going there at age 12 or so, obviously there's no romance that can brew there. But over time you see that, you know, now she's 21 and Dave's interest in her is not entirely paternal. But he's also very standoffish about it. And really he just wants to help her. He's known her for so long. And I have him in there because, you know, I was a little uncomfortable with the idea of the woman needing a man to rescue her. But I was also fond of the idea of counting on your friends in a time of need, you know, and her friend happens to be male. And so so Dave helps her out as things get worse and worse in the Olmsted house. And I like the idea that she was potentially going to escape into something that was really the life that was intended for her.
So you actually write this story, Rebecca Coleman, from several vantage points. Point of view shifts between the characters. Was that a challenge, or were there any challenges inherent in that? And why did you want to do it from the different vantage points as opposed to just one?
I always feel like if you present a story from the points of view of several of the players, that you get a more well-rounded look at the story and that you can show aspects of it that would otherwise be hidden. So I did it for that reason. People often ask me if it was if it's challenging to write in the different voices. I just didn't really feel that it was. I feel like they come naturally if you know the character well. And so it's told from Jill and Cade's points of view and from Leela's. And Leela was a really interesting voice to write because she uses a lot of religious quotes, and she brings up her religion frequently, but I don't think she does it in an overbearing way at all, the way Candy does. So to come up with her voice was something new for me in writing. And she's also much older than me, and I feel like it's very hard to write the voice of someone you haven't yet been, at a stage you haven't been at yet.
And so how do you kind of discover your characters deep enough to have their voice come through you naturally?
Well, they say that, you know, if you know the character's motivation, then you know the character. You know, each of us has something that we want in life, each of us has something that deeply moves us, people that we love, goals that we have. Those are all the things that you need to know about a character, whether or not they actually appear in the book. They may never appear in the book, but the writer has to know them. And so, you know those things. And then to make the voices a little bit nuanced, this sounds kind of strange, but there's a whole YouTube series that's called, I forget the name of it, but it's colloquial voices in the United States, where people pronounce things in their different accents and they say things in the way that's natural for their state or their region. And I watched a lot of that to get a sense of how people in New Hampshire, where they're from, close to the Canadian border, how they would talk and what the nuances of their speech would be like. And I was actually kind of irritated because in one part I had said, one of the characters says that something is down cellar, and my editor changed it to down in the cellar. And I was so mad when I saw that come out in print because I thought, I did that on purpose. You weren't supposed to change that.
That's a great story. So your last novel that we spoke to you about was Kingdom of Childhood, which also, you know, features good and evil in it, I would say, or a character getting deeper into evil. In some ways, I thought, you know, there's some parallel to Cade. Somebody goes further into a darker place and then begins to unravel in that place.
Right.
Yeah. So what are you trying to say there? What is your lesson that you're drawing out with now two novels that explore somebody who, you know, who could be any of us and who gets into a place that few of us really will end up in or certainly want to end up in.
Right. Well, in The Kingdom of Childhood, it was the teacher who has an affair with a 16-year-old male student. And then in Heaven Should Fall, it's Cade, whose grief gets out of control, and then he decides, you know, to seek revenge on the government. And both of those, both of those situations, I feel like are the most exciting things to write, where you're really pushing people to feel a little bit uncomfortable, and challenging the point to which people's emotions will go before it's just too uncomfortable for them to deal with. And for some people, I definitely hit that point. And for most people, hopefully, I didn't quite. But I feel like the point of reading is to immerse yourself in a world that's different from your own, and to be able to experience situations that you will never find yourself in, and go places that you haven't been, and sort of experiment in your mind with different worlds and ways of living. And so for these characters to do things that sometimes reflect some of our worst desires, or like in Kingdom of Childhood, most of us would not have an affair with a 16-year-old boy. But most of us would have an experience of wanting someone who was bad for us, that we knew we shouldn't have. And in Heaven Should Fall, most of us would not decide to blow up government buildings, but most of us have also felt real anger that we knew would eat us alive if we let it.
Right.
And so with both of these characters, I really tried to take the reader on a sort of dark flight of fancy. If you allowed yourself to be taken over by that emotion, what would happen? And then you kind of go along on it, and hopefully at the end of it you realize, whew, glad I didn't do that. but it allows you to follow along the lines of that without actually experiencing it yourself.
So in a way, you're writing a kind of a tale with a moral to it.
I think that they are moral tales in a way, but I don't feel like I'm moralizing. It's more, I think, helping people figure out what they believe is right, and figuring out where in your mind you draw the line and say, no, that's not acceptable. The reactions to Kingdom of Childhood, which I've had more of at this point because it's been out for a year, were really fascinating in that way, because there are some people who are very sympathetic and who say, you know, we all do things that we regret, and we all do things we're not proud of, and who understand Judy, the main character in that book. And then there are people who are completely repulsed by it and give me these, you know, absolutely scathing reviews, where you can tell that they were challenged by it and they thought, no, 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 I am just not even going to think about this. I cannot even entertain this in my mind. And I feel like that's the kind of moral drive of the books, is to that for some people it's too much. And I understand that some people read to escape. You know, they don't read because they want to think about anything that's really difficult, and that's totally understandable. But usually when I read books, it's because I want a challenge.
This is Writer's Voice, and we're talking with Rebecca Coleman about her new novel, Heaven Should Fall. And you're really challenging the readers with some very hot-button issues. I mean, Kingdom of Childhood, it's child sexual abuse. In this one, it's terrorism, and it's domestic terrorism. You know, a lot of Americans, I think of terrorism as something that people other than us do. But you've got character here that is an American and could be almost anyone here.
Right, and because I read so much about Tim McVeigh, and that's something where we've almost forgotten about it, because at the time that the Murrah Federal Building was bombed, that was before 9/11, and so our memory has been sort of taken over, you know, as far as terrorism goes, by 9/11, and we've sort of forgotten that our own people can do those things if they're angry enough and disenfranchised enough. And reading about Tim McVeigh and his background for it, you know, I don't like glorifying the bad guy, but in his background, you know, he had failed romance. He had a lot of debt, a lot of financial debt, and he was disenfranchised at work. And it shows how deep-seated frustration and feeling like you are not making a difference in the world, And maybe your one chance to make a difference in the world is to make a difference in a very harmful way. And that can become an obsession. Those are things that I think are very pertinent for our time when we are living in this economy and when there are a lot of very frustrated, disenfranchised people out there. And so it's worthwhile to think about, you know, how can we prevent these types of things from occurring and prevent these types of negative emotions in ourselves by addressing what it is that causes people to lose it.
Yeah, and of course, not too long ago, we had, 20 children and 6 adults gone down. I mean, it's not the same circumstance, but one does have a sense of the boy who committed those murders, who was profoundly disaffected and alienated.
Right, and I really thought about that on that horrible day. You know, I have 4 kids in school, and, you know, it affected me definitely as profoundly as it did all of us. And it's something where it caused us all to really think about our society and whether our society is fragmented and whether there's too much violence in our minds that causes people to think, well, I'm really angry. I know what I can do. I can commit an act of violence. And what we can do about that. And so I feel like that perhaps Heaven Should Fall could be helpful in contributing to the conversation about that, about American society and the violence that can be part of our culture and what we can do about that and whether it should be at the level that it's at.
Well, it's a terrific book, Heaven Should Fall. It's a great read.
Thank you.
Thank you so much, Rebecca Coleman, for speaking with us here on Writer's Voice about it.
Well, it's been great talking to you. I appreciate it a lot.
You can read an excerpt from Heaven Should Fall by going to writersvoice.net. That's it this week for Writer's Voice. Go to writersvoice.net to listen to or download past shows, plus find out more about our guests or read book excerpts. You can also sign up to get the show delivered straight to your inbox or subscribe to the podcast and the newsletter. And follow us on Twitter at Writer's Voice, all one word. Then check out my blog, Francesca Rhiannon at blogspot.com. You can find lots of cool stuff there. The Writer's Voice webmaster is Bill Way. I'm your host, Francesca Rhiannon.